Welcome to the Dialogue Journal podcast, where we bring you thought-provoking discussions and readings that explore the rich and complex world of Mormon thought. I'm Taylor Petrie, editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Today's episode features a very special recording of Gregory Prince delivering his paper, A Tribute to Lester Bush on the 50th Anniversary of the Article That Changed the Church. This paper was originally presented on June 9, 2023, at a session of the Mormon History Association Conference. It honors the 50th anniversary of Lester Bush's groundbreaking 1973 article in Dialogue, Mormonism's Negro Doctrine and Historical Overview. The impact of Bush's work cannot be overstated. It reshaped how scholars, church members, and leaders alike understood the history and implications of the priesthood and temple restrictions for Black members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Gregory Prince's tribute reflects on the enduring significance of that article, its author, and the scholarship it inspired. Before we begin, please note that the views expressed in this episode represent those of the author and not necessarily those of Dialogue, the Mormon History Association, or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The paper is also featured in the fall 2024 issue of Dialogue as part of a roundtable commemorating the 50th anniversary of Lester Bush's landmark publication. If you haven't read it yet, we encourage you to check it out at dialoguejournal.com. As we celebrate this history, we're also looking forward to the Mormon History Association's upcoming events. Mark your calendars for the 60th annual Mormon History Association Conference happening June 5th to 8th, 2025 in Ogden, Utah. This year's theme, Junctions and Communities, invites us to explore how the Restoration Movement has intersected with diverse cultures, histories, and influences, both globally and locally. Ogden, known as Junction City, is a fitting setting for such a conversation. Its unique history, shaped by indigenous trade routes, the arrival of the railroad, and waves of migration, has made it a hub of diversity and cultural exchange. And don't miss the Mormon History Association's Latter-day Histories Lecture Series, a three-part program featuring cutting-edge research in Mormon history. The next lecture includes Jason Palmer on Peruvian Mormon Mujeristas, moderated by Elise Boxer on January 9, 2025, and Ameche Okafor, discussing Mormonism in Africa, an indigenous perspective, moderated by Dima Hulbert on March 6, 2025. Stay tuned for more information on how to register, and remember that proceeds from this series support the streaming and recording of MHA's annual conference. Now, without further ado, here's Gregory Prince reading A Tribute to Lester Bush on the 50th Anniversary of the Article That Changed the Church.
When the Dialogue office moved from Stanford to Los Angeles, it found a home in the Religious Conference Center, which was kitty-corner from the UCLA School of Dentistry, where I was a student. Occasionally, I would drop by the office to see what was happening in Mormon studies. One time, I noticed a thick, black, bound volume with the intriguing title, Compilation on the Negro in Mormonism. I thumbed through it and was fascinated to see what its author had assembled on a topic that had been only in the periphery of my consciousness until I went to Brazil in 1967 on an LDS mission. There I encountered not only the policy excluding blacks from priesthood ordination, but also the impossibility of determining accurately whether someone had the blood, as we indelicately called it, in a country that was a racial melting pot. Indeed, that impossibility weighed heavily on Spencer Kimball, after he announced the construction of a temple in Brazil, entrance to which would have been denied to anyone with black African ancestry. I wanted a copy of the compilation. It had the mailing address of the compiler, Lester Bush, who had sent the volume to Dialogue along with the manuscript. I sent a letter to the address, which was an APO box. It was forwarded to Lester in Saigon, where he was on assignment from his employer, the Central Intelligence Agency. He soon wrote back and told me he had prepared a very small number of the compilations and was not able to comply with my request. I quickly moved on to other interests. 2 years later, having completed graduate studies at UCLA, my wife and I moved to Maryland for postdoctoral fellowship at the National Institutes of Health. We purchased a home in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., and began to attend the Gaithersburg Ward. Several weeks later, we were asked to speak in our new congregation. After the service, a gentleman approached me and said, "I enjoyed your talk. I'm Lester Bush." He and his family had moved into the ward the previous year. A month later, we were invited to join a new study group that met in his home, one that still meets in ours nearly a half century later. Lester soon became and remained my closest friend. For more than 40 years, we spent countless hours together discussing every imaginable topic within Mormonism. His interest in Mormon teachings about blacks was initiated by George Romney's gubernatorial victory in Michigan in 1962 and further fed by four events in 1963. The announcement, which turned out to be premature, of a proselytizing mission to Nigeria, aspirational comments by First Presidency member Hubie Brown about the possibility of admitting blacks into the priesthood, a pro-civil rights statement read by Brown in General Conference, and a statement by Joseph Fielding Smith that the church was not about to change its policy. Lester later wrote, "Like many others, I started a file on this increasingly awkward and public subject. Unlike others, with me the topic became an obsession." Indeed, he told me, he thought one needed to a certain amount of obsessive compulsive disorder to be a good historian. Those are self-knowing laughs. He published his finding in the hope that others would come to a similar understanding that might change the church's policy, but not as an overt act of advocacy. Raised in Virginia and attending the University of Virginia for undergraduate and medical schools, Lester had no access to archival materials until his medical internship at LDS Hospital in Salt Lake City in the late 1960s. Conversations at the hospital with two of David O. McKay's sons, Llewellyn, who was a patient, and Edward, who was a physician, informed him that there was more latitude on the subject within the hierarchy than he had supposed. This was an era when Joseph Fielding Smith was still church historian and kept a tight lid on sensitive resources in the archives. Although Lester had limited success in penetrating the curtain there, he found a trove of documents at BYU and the University of Utah, including a 1968 letter from Sterling McMurrin to Llewellyn describing a 1954 meeting with President McKay, where the president spoke of the issue, quote, as a practice, not a doctrine, and the practice will someday be changed, end quote. He was able to flesh out a compelling story that bore little resemblance to the official narrative, one that remains intact to this day, much as Juanita Brooks's Mountain Meadows Massacre narrative does. Eventually, Lester arranged his sources chronologically in the 400-page compilation I first saw at UCLA and began to write while stationed in the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. In the spring of 1973, he sent his manuscript to Dialogue. He also sent a copy to LDS Apostle Boyd Packer, who through intermediaries had expressed interest in it. Very soon after receiving it, Packer sent word through those intermediaries that he and his colleagues were anxious that he, quote, not publish the material until after he had talked with a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, end quote. Through phone and in-person conversations with Packer, Lester learned that he had no issues with the data in his manuscript. Indeed, Packer knew far less about the details than Lester, but he was trying to delay or block its publication without saying so directly. Packer said to him, if those people, the Dialogue editors, thought we were interested in delaying, they would just hurry faster to get it published. Nonetheless, direct pressure was applied to Bob Rees, the Dialogue editor, by Robert Thomas, academic vice president of BYU, who suggested its publication would cause newly appointed church historian Leonard Arrington to lose his job. Also, pressure on the Los Angeles stake president by unnamed senior church leaders. The stake president contacted Brent Rushforth, the Dialogue co-editor, living in his ward, and told him the brethren were concerned about the article being published. Rushforth told him he would be happy to speak directly with the brethren and gave him his phone number. The call was never made, and the article was published without further incident. Brent learned many years later that pressure had been put on that stake president to excommunicate him and Bob Rees. Leonard Arrington's tenure as church historian was still several years after Lester did his research. And so Lester did not meet the professional historians until he had completed the manuscript. The enthusiasm with which they received him was genuine, in part because he had done what they could not do. Many years later, he learned that even at the height of Camelot, they were prohibited from researching core topics that included blacks and priesthood. Lester was their avatar. 2 years after the article was published, Packer told Scott Kenney, the editor of newly launched Sunstone, that he was still displeased that Lester had published it, quote, against general authority counsel during a time of threats and violence against the church, end quote. 6 months after it was published, Lester passed through Salt Lake City en route to Washington, D.C., and met with General Authority Hardeman Rector, who told him all the general authorities had read it, something Lester dismissed as an overstatement, and there had been no groundswell of opposition following its publication. When Lester and his family moved to Maryland in 1974, he received a note from General Authority Marion D. Hanks, who told him Lester's work, quote, probably had a far greater effect than was acknowledged to you or than has yet been evidenced. Recent conversations suggest this is so, end quote. 2 decades later, when I interviewed Hanks for my biography of David O. McKay, he reiterated this thought by telling me Lester's article had had far more influence than the Brethren would ever acknowledge. It started to foment the pot. Reaction among the LDS historical community was uniformly favorable. Shortly after the article was published, Leonard Arrington said that there was, quote, a relief that it was finally out in print where it could be discussed, and made an analogy to the relief felt when Mountain Meadows Massacre was published by Juanita Brooks. Although the article will always be regarded as Lester's most important, indeed, I believe it was the most consequential article in the field of Mormon studies published in the 20th century, it was only the beginning of his contributions to the field. Shortly after Lester moved to Maryland in 1974, Dialogue moved to nearby Virginia, and he became associate editor. He recruited me as book review editor, and I saw firsthand how he shaped much of Mormon scholarship during his years in that position. And Jalen and I would go to his home every Sunday evening for dinner, followed by wide-ranging discussions of topics that needed scholarly treatment. Then he either would go to the person most expert in the field and request an article for Dialogue, or if no one was expert, he would recruit someone. Resulting from the scholarship he nurtured were unprecedented and definitive articles on the Adam God Doctrine, the Second Anointing, and Tony Hutchinson's landmark study, A Mormon Midrash, LDS Creation Narratives Reconsidered, which more than anything preceding it defined the revelatory process of Joseph Smith. The articles published during his tenure in the aggregate represent a high water mark in the journal's 6 decades of existence. A medical doctor, Lester also wrote a definitive article on birth control among the Mormons, an underappreciated book commissioned by religious historian Martin Marty entitled Health and Medicine Among the Latter-day Saints, and in his final contribution to Mormon studies, a timely and probing Dialogue article with the provocative title Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. Prior to 1978, he and I had rarely discussed his article on blacks and priesthood. Publishing the article had been secondary to his own quest to understand the policy, and he felt his work was accomplished with its publication. I once asked if he thought the policy would ever change. Perhaps, he answered, but not for at least 15 years, an oblique reference to men he assumed would need to graduate before it could change. He spoke frequently on the topic to groups in the D.C. area, always with a good number of African Americans in the audience. He told me he could predict the point in his presentation at which there would be the aha moment. Oh, now we get it. This is just white guys being racist. We were worried God hated us. On June 8, 1978, Lester's wife, Yvonne, called me at work and said she had just heard on good authority that Spencer Kimball had received a revelation allowing all worthy males to receive the priesthood. And Lester was doing some medical work at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and his brother managed to reach him before Yvonne could to give him the good news. Jalen and I spent the evening at the Bush home. My diary entry was brief. Quote, Lester has had such an intense interest in the church policy on blacks that the shock and delight of this announcement is nearly overwhelming. He received phone calls all evening from all over the country. We can't help but think that his monumental paper on the black policy had something to do with the turn of events, end quote. A quarter century later, Lester told me he assumed his article's impact was probably in preparing the way by raising doubts in the minds of leaders about the conventional wisdom. The revelation was the good news, but beneath that good news was a gradual covert effort to shun Lester, an embodiment of the aphorism, no good deed goes unpunished. While Lester never complained and few recognized the process, I saw it up close. Its first embodiment started in the mid-1970s. In 1975, President Kimball announced the reconstitution of the First Quorum of 70. In elevating the office to general authority status, he discontinued it at the local level, a move that resulted in the ordination of all local 70s to the office of high priest. The move simultaneously redefined the role of high priest, which had been one of presidency. With the change, nearly any man over the age of 30 who was an active church member became a high priest, except Lester. A decade or more older than the next oldest member of the elders' quorum, he became an obvious outlier. I spoke several times to his stake president, who was my neighbor and a close friend, and urged him to rectify the situation. I told him we were at great risk of losing Lester if he continued to be shunned. He said he would investigate it, but he never acted on it. I knew him well enough to read between the lines. Someone at a higher level had sent a message. Among those who took an interest in church history, the euphoria of the 1978 revelation was gradually replaced by anguish over the disintegration of what was being called the New Mormon history, which was an evolution from devotional to databased history. Although we were enthralled with the early output of Leonard Arrington's History Division, it set off alarms at church headquarters. Unwilling to concede the writing of the church's history to professional historians, senior apostles Ezra Taft Benson and Mark Peterson, with an ample assist from junior apostle Boyd Packer, set about to undermine Leonard Arrington's franchise. Because of his dialogue article and his editorship, Lester was a clearinghouse of information regarding church history. In mid-1981, he told me there had been a secret meeting the prior week at the historical department that included all historians working for the church. G. Homer Durham, its executive director, told them they were no longer to conduct any research except what was specifically assigned to them by the church. The archives would be closed to them for personal research, even after hours. Without any discussion, he closed the meeting and announced that he would not be available for comment as he was leaving for a 5-week vacation. It was another step in the ending of Leonard Arrington's franchise. His demotion as church historian, cancellation of the 16-volume sesquicentennial history, transfer of the historical department to BYU, and now closure of the archives to independent research by church employees. By 1982, the work of Benson, Peterson, and Packer was done. Those who hungered for the truth about their religious history became part of Boyd Packer's triad of enemies of the church, along with feminists and homosexuals. The decade-long era, later called Camelot by former assistant church historian Davis Bitten, was gone. Buoyed by his success, Mark Peterson unilaterally turned his attention to historians whose paychecks were not signed by the church. He had two assistants draw up a list of 8 men, later expanded in number, whose writings he saw as threatening to the church, and personally called the stake president of each. His instructions were to call in these men and check on their, quote, worthiness, end quote. 7 of the stake presidents responded with varying levels of adverse action. The 8th president was different. I knew something about it because he was also my stake president, a man I had gotten to know well over the 4 years I was an Elders Quorum president and reported directly to him, Bill Marriott. In late March of 1983, as word of Peterson's phone call spread, Lester debriefed me about meetings he had attended in Salt Lake City concerning medical issues. He was approached by a high-ranking church bureaucrat privately and asked if he would offer advice on a new section of the General Handbook of Instructions devoted to policy and ethical issues with a particular focus on medicine. The man emphasized to Lester that no one must know of his collaboration given Lester's reputation at church headquarters. Although the man had worked with an internal committee to draft a statement on technological breakthroughs in reproductive medicine, including artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, and surrogate motherhood, he was not satisfied with the draft document. Lester put in a lot of effort and completely reworked the draft he was given. The eventual published version contained virtually everything Lester had recommended, something that until that time only four people in the church knew: the church bureaucrat, Lester, his wife Yvonne, and me. The same night he told me about the medical issues, and with irony you can't make up, Lester received a phone call from our stake executive secretary asking that he meet with the stake president the following evening. By then, we knew the identity of Peterson's other targets. The executive secretary gave no indication of the agenda, and neither he nor the stake president knew or would ever know of Lester's high-level collaboration on medical ethical issues. We speculated that the message might be that he must stop writing and speaking, or worse, that he might be the subject of formal church discipline for what he had already published. Immediately after the meeting with the stake president, Lester drove to my home and gave me a full account of a rather surprising conversation. Marriott began by saying he'd become aware that Lester had written important articles, and he wondered if Lester would tell him about them. Having assumed he would be on the defensive, Lester was prepared. He gave a two-hour, in-depth summary of his writings, with particular focus on Mormonism's Negro policy, and a detailed account of the problems he had encountered along the way. The stake president listened intently, and as the meeting ended, he invited Lester to meet with him any time he wished to talk about the historical issues. We had heard of the experiences of others who were on Peterson's list and were surprised and pleased that this one was different. In May 1983, 6 weeks after their initial meeting, Lester took Marriott up on his prior offer of being willing to meet again. In the second meeting, Marriott spoke to the genesis of their prior meeting, saying Peterson had pressed him to be harsh with Lester. Marriott later told me, quote, he had received a phone call from an apostle, Peterson, in which he was asked if one Lester Bush lived in his stake. Yes, he replied. Take his temple recommend away, was the response, whereupon the apostle abruptly hung up the phone. Upon consulting with the local regional representative of the 12, who was also one of Marriott's employees, Marriott decided not to comply with the letter of the law by meeting with Lester, but avoiding vindictiveness. Knowing of my friendship with Lester, he later told me of the directive from Elder Peterson. His words to me, I wouldn't do it because it was wrong. Would that all church leaders had the moral compass of Bill Marriott. 2 days after Lester's second meeting with Marriott, we met for lunch. He said he had been asked to prepare, without attribution, a policy statement that would go out over the signatures of the first presidency concerning medical ethical issues. The left hand had no idea what the right hand was doing. As an aside, the bureaucrat who had requested Lester's input told him the secretary to the first presidency, with whom he had frequently met, quote, admitted that the first presidency read dialogue regularly, though they were not pleased with some of the articles, end quote. In late April 1983, the bureaucrat called Lester and invited him to a special meeting with the Special Affairs Committee at which the policy statements would be presented for approval. He offered to pay Lester's way. It was a tempting invitation, but Lester knew he could not attend without causing a backlash. He conveyed his appreciation, but said he wanted to see the statement adopted, more than he wanted to attend the meeting, and he knew it must be one or the other. 2 weeks later, we attended the annual meeting of the Mormon History Association in Omaha, Nebraska. Shortly after we arrived, I ran into Leonard Arrington. The first thing he asked me was, "What do you know about the rumors we've heard about Lester?" As we compared notes, he filled in the missing pieces of the puzzle. Mark Peterson, upset at Seventh East Press for publishing an interview with Sterling McMurrin, instructed two of his aides, Tom Truitt and Roy Doxey, to compile a hit list of people associated with the newspaper. When they came up with four names, Peterson decided to expand the list to cover other suspicious characters. The completed list contained eight names, including Lester. Although Marriott had not taken adverse action, the shunning Lester received from other quarters, including remaining an elder and never having a church calling after the late 1970s, took a cumulative toll. And by the mid-1990s, he had withdrawn completely from church activity, as has had all three of his children. In June 1997, I met with Marlon Jensen, a member of the First Quorum of 70 who later became church historian. He told me of his interest in learning more about unresolved issues regarding blacks in the church. I did not know at the time that he had been assigned by the First Presidency to chair a committee to review church-published materials that might still contain racist content. I conveyed his interest to Lester, and later in the year, he came by my home and gave me a 200-page manuscript he wrote in response to Jensen's inquiry, which described the writing of his dialogue article. When I met with Jensen and showed him the manuscript, he asked if Lester had ever been subjected to formal discipline. I said he had not, that all the action taken against him was sub rosa. His reply, "That's the worst." Lester later transformed that manuscript into an article published in the Journal of Mormon History on the silver anniversary of his original article. In 2000, Lester was writing a family history and asked if I would give him extracts from my diary that detailed our interactions over the prior quarter century. Those extracts amounted to 100 pages. One entry speculated that his withdrawal from church activity was caused by the cumulative pain of shunning. Upon reading it, he said it was less a matter of having endured too much pain and more one of seeing the church change its colors concerning things of the mind, such that there was a decreasing amount of room for people such as he. He later allowed that one of the reasons he had finally walked away from church activity was that he had never been invested socially in the organization. That is, he had not received any significant church calling. Shunning. 1 month after the inauguration of Barack Obama in 2009, we hosted a dinner in our home that included Lester and Brent Rushforth, co-editors of Dialogue, when Lester's article was published. During dinner, Brent said that he had had house guests for the inauguration, Jordan and Rebecca Kimball. Jordan was a grandson of Spencer Kimball. Brent told Jordan he had wondered for years whether Lester's article had had any influence on his grandfather. Jordan replied, "You don't need to wonder." He then told a story that his wife later put on the record for me. It began with a conversation between Jordan, his father Ed, and Rebecca. Quote, Ed brought up that he had been contacted regarding a rumor floating around about a Kimball grandson having discovered the Lester Bush landmark article in Dialogue heavily marked up in Spencer Kimball's home office after his death. It stood out because it was the only article among the Dialogue issues heavily underlined in red, which was consistent with Kimball's style of marking up. We told Ed that we could confirm that rumor. Jordan and I haven't told many people, maybe only a couple over the years, about our discovery until we were at the Rush Force in January 2009. I remember Brent saying he and others had wondered if Dialogue publishing Lester Bush's article might have made any difference in influencing church leaders before the 1978 revelation. And then both Jordan and I assured him we thought it had, and shared our discovery, end quote. Several weeks ago, Chris Kimball, another grandson of Spencer W., spoke at our home and confirmed that he, too, had seen his grandfather's copy of dialogue and that it was annotated as Rebecca had described. In late 2014, I sent an email to Elder Jeffrey Holland, who I'd known for over 40 years, asking if anything could be done to affirm to Lester that his work had been beneficial to the church. He promptly replied that although he had no official reason to reach out to Lester, he would look for an opportunity. In February 2015, Lester was invited to give the Sterling McMurrin Lecture at the University of Utah. He called me the following day and said he was on the fence as to whether to accept the invitation, in part because he had had virtually no contact with the church for many years. I pointed out that I could think of only two people in the history of the church who would forever be considered the founders of scholarship on important topics: Juanita Brooks on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and he on blacks and priesthood. Everything that had been written since their initial works had built on them without materially changing their findings. Lester could not name a third person. Game over. The lecture was in October. I thought it might be the opening for a meeting with Elder Holland, and so I wrote to him. In September, Lester and I received an invitation from his secretary to meet him for breakfast the morning after the lecture. The night of the lecture, Lester, Yvonne, and I had dinner with Marlon Jensen, then the emeritus church historian. He listened intently as Lester told the story of how he came to write about blacks and priesthood and was visibly pained to hear of the harsh treatment and shunning it caused. At several points along the way, he told Lester how much his writing had meant to him and how much it had meant to the church. Although Elder Jensen did not attempt to apologize on behalf of the church, the fact that the prior church historian was so affirming went a long way towards healing wounds that had festered for four decades. The four of us then drove the short distance to the University of Utah campus for Lester's lecture. Bob Goldberg, chair of the event, ushered Lester and Yvonne to the green room. And a short time later, when I saw Darius Gray enter the auditorium, I gathered him and Marlon and told them they were about to witness history. I then took them to the green room where Lester and Darius met in person for the first time. The following morning, we met Elder Holland for breakfast. As Lester told him about his life and about the article on blacks and priesthood, it became clear that he knew only the broadest outlines of the story and nothing of the shunning by church leaders in general and the adverse action taken by Mark Peterson in particular. Elder Holland said Juanita Brooks had been his English teacher when he was a student at Dixie College, and he idolized her for what she had done. He compared Lester to Juanita, saying, "You two are pillars on which important parts of church history rest," end quote. As he walked us to our car, he put his arm around Lester's shoulder and said, "Lester, you have made church history, and I am grateful for that." Hours after the breakfast, Elder Holland sent me an email. "I loved every minute of my time with you and Lester. I found him to be delightful. I hope he felt my genuine interest in and true admiration for his work." A few days later, Elder Holland copied me on an email. "Lester, I don't know when I have enjoyed a morning more than the one I had with you and Greg. I only wish we had had another hour or two together. I hope you will stay in touch with me and share anything you will write. I will be edified and blessed by it," end quote. 3 years later, Lester and I flew to Salt Lake City for the 40th anniversary of the 1978 Revelation. The morning of the anniversary celebration, I took Lester to the church library, which he had never seen. Hearing Lester was in the building, Steve Snow, then church historian, came down from his office to greet us. He was most cordial, and he reiterated how grateful he and others were for the scholarship that Lester had done. The wounds were healed, and just in time. It turned out to be my last trip with Lester. Early signs of dementia, which had taken the lives of his father and mother, had begun to appear. 1 year later, he and Yvonne moved to California to be close to their sons. Within a year of their arrival there, Lester entered a memory care facility. We are all indebted to Lester, upon whose shoulders others have stood and will continue to stand. An amateur with no professional training in historiography, he set a standard that many will admire but few will surpass or even reach. Perhaps deep within his memory remains the knowledge that he changed the church. Thank you.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.